Wednesday, 29th August, 1973.
Depending upon your particular temperament, some may find it easier to follow the usual way logically regarding our procedure for considering these things as a logical discourse, and others may find it easier not to be concerned with it as a logical discourse, but use it as a means of what I might call a meditative feeling process, by virtue of which you awake and respond to the essence of what is being put forward. The best thing, of course, is to be able to combine both. But that is rather rare. We tend to be rather more this way or that way, the logical discourse type or the meditative feeling type. Exceptionally, you find the two in balance. But that is as you please. Let us recall a very important point we touched upon yesterday regarding right mindfulness. Namely, when we pay attention to that part of mindfulness which represents the mindfulness of the manner in which our own brain is talking back at all the impressions we receive and the observations we make. Instead of being aware in terms of I am violent or angry or feeling generous or kind, or he is doing just these things, be aware in terms of this is violence or kindness and so on. This point is extremely important, because do remember that where this general mindfulness is concerned, which goes on throughout the day, we are constantly in touch with the world as a whole. These are our reactions all through the 24 hours to the environment around us and to the upsurge of thought or feeling or desire or sensation from within our own body or mind. Therefore, it is something which touches the whole. And if we are aware in terms of wholeness with respect to it, that this is violence or evil, that this is kindness or good, in the relative ambivalent sphere still, then we are functioning more in terms of wholeness than in terms of particularity. This makes one's sense of universality grow. And with the growth and the intensifying of that sense of universality, the sense of separate selfhood selfhood diminishes till finally just naturally disappears. It is no longer there. You must think out for yourself the consequence of this transformation of the manner in which we are aware of our everyday existence. The more we are conscious in terms of particularity, the more difficult, the more terrible are the consequences of self-centered awareness. You can watch this. You can be mindful of this, particularly in conversation. Note how most conversation centers round the word I. Occasionally the word you, at least out of sheer courtesy. Usually it is centered around the word I. And you will notice that when we are not talking with other people, all the fantasy life that goes on, our daydreaming, our fantasying, our preoccupation with thought, as we call it, is definitely centered around nothing but the I. All the time. Which means that we are constantly generating a psychical energy which tends not towards harmony with the whole, but to cutting ourselves off from the whole. You know, this has tremendous consequences. The repercussions of all this are very powerful indeed in our everyday life. So, right mindfulness implies this as a very important factor in it. There is another factor which comes up there. Mindfulness is certainly the most powerful purifying agent, psychical power in our being. Mindfulness, the purifying agent, which means that what we call living, observing the silas, morality, the simple moralities no longer become merely a matter of personal morality. When we include everybody in this type of mindfulness, we get freer and freer of criticism of others. This does not mean that we must fall into that trap which so many sweet-natured people do fall into. Oh, he's such a nice little darling after all, and this, that and the other. He didn't mean to do any harm or anything. Oh, no. Be perfectly honest and matter-of-fact. That man behaved like a horrible swine. That's the fact. All right, that's the fact, you see. But if you can see it as this is horribly swinish behavior, then your seeing it with that clarity cleanses the whole psychical atmosphere and doesn't leave you just tied up with that attitude of judgment, a condemnatory judgment upon the other. You observe the fact. And you are free of condemnatory judgment. What then? You are in communion with him. This is the state of love, not of hate. The other is the state of hate. If, on the other hand, you are beside yourself with admiration and appreciation of something nice in the other person, you become attached. You see? And in becoming attached, the tendency is that you make yourself an awful nuisance to him. And so on. See, again and again, do remember, never take leave of good sense. What I'm trying to suggest all the time along these lines is this disciplinary procedure, which is preeminently a sensible procedure. Because if we are not sensible, then the result is certainly, well, not a very satisfactory or happy result. All right. So you see how morality is tied up with right mindfulness. And it is tied up specifically with this general mindfulness which is exercised right throughout the day. Now, let us consider that other aspect of meditation. We started this on Sunday morning, you remember. We started considering meditation on Sunday morning. And we just emphasized its very general meaning, that meditation in its reality means total communion, perfect communion. Now we come, and all this prepares the ground and eases the path for perfect communion. Perfect samadhi, that is. Samadhi really means that. Sang-adhi, the total or complete togetherness. Adhi really means supreme, but supreme would in this case mean total or perfect. Togetherness. Therefore, if we say in English the full, perfect communion, we are as near the truth as any other word or phrase is. Now, with regard to specific meditation, here, morality is the indispensable basis. What interferes with specific meditation practice? It's all the defilements in our own mind. And the defilements of the mind are frequently associated with the body, particularly in this sense. From childhood onwards, we are so enmeshed in self-indulgence. Now this is perfectly natural. This is exactly how it happens. The body is an animal body. The tremendous upsurge of energy inside the body, our life energy, this electrochemical process which is overwhelmingly active, all this is directed towards emphasizing egohood, the self. We have first to grow to full awareness of self. Of selfness also. I am I. That has to come to fruition, but it has to come to fruition in the healthy way, the right way, the happy way. Rarely only do parents, educators, and our environment help us along those lines. All too often they do not help us, simply because to start with, our parents dearly beloved as they are frightfully ignorant themselves. But never mind that. We have to come to the fullness of egohood, the fullness of separate individuality. We are a whole within the body and psyche. After that, let us say that the first 25 years of life or 30 years should be sufficient for that. Should be. These are rather ideal outlooks. Supposing it is done within the first 25 or 30 years, then comes that further stage where, having made this a whole organism, we grow into the awareness, the full awareness of wholeness in relationship to the totality. Now, if I do succeed in that, I am the true individual, the true indivisible. For this reason, in this, as an animal organism, individuality is necessarily confined to the organism. My dog or cat or a tiger or an elephant cannot transcend consciousness of himself in relationship to the environment, which to him is there in order to sustain and nourish him. So he continuously draws unto himself, draws the world unto himself. Now, we as human beings do likewise. In order to earn our living, as we say, to have food, warmth, shelter, etc., and as we say, sometimes rightly and truly, to make our contribution to society. So we draw unto ourselves. Now, you remember we talked about the law of the mind and the law of the body, the law of the spirit, and we regarded them as two cones. Remember? Turned one over the other like that. The law of the mind is different. Now, we expand into the universe again. And here, we realize wholeness in terms of consciousness, in terms of full awareness, which altogether changes the quality and the nature of all our activities, physical and mental, throughout the day. Now, in this changing, when we grow into this awareness of totality, a new meaning of individuality has come into being. Now, henceforth, I, the individual, am no longer just this thing here which you see before you. But the real meaning of I, for me then, has become the totality. That is I. That is the meaning of the word I. And it has reality only insofar as it has not a vestige of separateness involved anywhere. That means that this person is totally involved in the world as a whole, has become completely involved with it. There is nothing which is separate for this person. This is the final unity possible of realization by man. Then at last I am the pure individual, the pure indivisible. And the great miracle of life has taken place. That through the finite self, obviously a finite self, this whole totality expresses itself. If you use theistic language, God comes to self-fulfillment in his totality through you, the particular separate man or woman. Now the other day I said I could tell you the purpose of man's existence. This is one way of expressing it. Now you see, specific meditation is one of the ways by which this state, this transcendental state, is released in and through the individual. Now consider what the Buddha taught with regard to specific meditation. You know how he said that the bhikkhu sits quietly in the appropriate place so that there's the least possible disturbance which could take place. And then he puts aside the hindrances. Now this is very important. Consider these hindrances. Lust, to start with. Then malevolence. Then worry and flurry. Then sloth and torpor. And doubt. Now notice carefully, every one of these has its origin and is associated with the body, the bodily life. This great electrochemical process which goes on here is the source of all these. It's the bondage brought into the psyche and the mental life by the body. You must work this out for yourself. If we start working it out here now or want to start, it will take days and days really. But work it out for yourself. And so the bhikkhu puts aside, as he says, these hindrances. But how do you put aside the hindrances as such? Yes. Remember what we considered yesterday. To fight the good fight, to overcome evil, is the wrong procedure. Because you just perpetuate the state of conflict. But to be non-resistant to the fact which you perceive enables you to absorb the truth, namely that there is malevolence here, and you absorb it in the state of quiet, not of rejection, not of conflict, and thereby that state undergoes a transformation. That psychical energy which when taking this form of expression is named malevolence, that same psychical energy changes out of that form and it becomes non-malevolent. Don't take this on trust from me. Practice and see what happens. Just practice and see. You have to be very, very patient. Took me years and years. But you could perhaps do it in 5 minutes maybe. No, don't have any preconception. You may, you never know. You see? It may happen that way. All right. So now, in this way, to be aware of what is present at the moment. And if you are aware in that right way, and you just absorb it, then some other power is enabled to operate. Because this self-power, which desires to produce
the end that it wants, namely out Mr. Malevolence, you see, is no longer operating. From inside me, the limited self, will always come weakness, not true strength. And true strength is infinite resilience, infinite absorptiveness, therefore. See, there's a profound meaning in Jesus' words, resist not evil. This is what I believe this is what he may have had in mind. Resist not evil. Because within you, well, we say in Buddhism, look within, thou art Buddha. There is this transcendent reality within us. And it is this transcendent energy which is everlastingly quiet. It does not ever impose its will or any such thing. It is in that quietness that it is so omnipotent. And it operates without opposition. It operates by the alchemy of transmutation. This is the marvel of transcendence. And so this begins to work in the psyche here and now. And you will find that what happens is true growth, not a mere mechanical put together, a sankhara, a sankata, but true integration, which is quite a different thing. Now it is in line with life. And so you see, you are in tune with life this way. So then put aside the hindrances that way. And then you enter into meditation proper. That is to say, in its technical aspect. Now here, as you all know so well, you start off with initial thought, discursive thought, vitakka, vichara, and so forth. Upon some particular subject worthy of meditation, many people, especially those who are devotionally inclined, like to picture the teacher. Very well. Visualize the teacher in the mind. He is adorned with all the virtues, the qualities, and so forth, as we say. But do remember, this is a picture. The intensity of your feeling puts life into that picture. But where is that picture? That picture is within you, although you imagine the Buddha or Jesus or Zarathustra or whoever it is as being in front of you or above you or something like that. But the picture is actually inside your mind as such. And it's right actually inside your brain box too. That's where the picture is. Now, this energized picture is something which intensifies your whole psyche. Your whole psyche. It intensifies what we commonly call in the ambivalent sphere, the good and the bad alike. You see, there is no actual Buddha or Christ or a perfected Holy One, a Yajnavalkya or a Parameshthin or anybody present to pick and choose and push out anything evil and let be anything good. Not at all. This process of meditation is a process of energizing This is one of the so-called dangers of meditation, and a very real one. It energizes both aspects. You know how, perhaps it was a couple of days ago, we touched upon this, that it is when you come out of the church absolutely lifted up to the stars with the sublimity of the service and this, that and the other, it is then that you are liable to explode most violently at some trivial little thing that you see happening 5 seconds later. See, so we have to bear this very carefully in mind, that it is an energizer of both aspects, because we are still within the ambivalent sphere, the sphere of either or, of the so-called good evil, virtue vice. However, there is no escape from this. One has to go through with it and be very, very mindful as we go through with it. And that is why you remember yesterday as well as the other day, I think on Sunday, I said, when we have gone through this and feel uplifted and so forth, remain quiet for as long a time as possible in order to get into that state where when we go out of the room and into the world, we will not get bowled over by an unpleasant impulse, a stimulus. Bear this carefully in mind. Now, what is the next step? What is the next condition, I would rather say? The condition which is spoken of as the second jhana. What is one of its outstanding points? It is the coming to an end of the thinking process, of the thought process. Now this seems to me to be the real key stage. It is the unlocking of the door. Well, that's not a good way of putting it. It is the falling away of that barrier which previously kept us confined within the limited and the particular, the mortal. The thought process is just a stream of words. Remember again Dhammadinna's words to Visakha. All discursive thought is activity of speech. All discursive thought is activity of speech. Do remember that. It's tremendously significant. Around it and through it and in it is a profounder reality called mind, true enough. But of that we are unaware. What we are aware, what we are conscious of, is this activity of speech, this flow of words. What does speech represent? Speech represents things, persons, objects, activities, actions, and so on. As we learn in grammar, nouns and verbs, naming words and doing words. And speech is that faculty we have whereby we integrate all our sense impressions. Because speech has the power to integrate all our sense impressions, we make sense of the world in which we live. Have you ever waited to analyze what happens when you decide, just let us say, to cook a meal. Just observe how all the different sense impressions are involved in that act of cooking a meal. The smell, the taste, what the stuff looks like, what you feel like, and all the rest of it. Everything is involved in that. And in your activity, which we call cooking a meal, your mind is constantly talking all the time, giving you directions, isn't it? But it's using words, it's using speech all the time. This speech faculty is the integrator of all our sense life. And when the mind, the intellectual aspect of our mind, is able to deal with concepts in more and more refined states, in states of greater and greater abstraction, so that we say that we are dealing purely with abstract thought, we must never be under the delusion that our abstract thought is a totally different world from all concrete thinking. The no-thing is rooted in the thing. The supreme example of abstract thinking is not even philosophy, but pure mathematics. When you come to the stage where you deal with equations, with symbols, from which even their meanings have disappeared. Let X represent this and Y represent that and so forth. You have stopped letting the representation business enter your mind. You're dealing absolutely with the symbols. Modern mathematics is the purest magic that there is in the world. It's absolutely fantastic. And all sorts of things evolve and you get a final equation which, if true, ought to bring about such and such results when you devise experiments to find out the truth of this final formula. This is the extraordinary thing that goes on in the world today. But that abstract procedure, remember, is rooted in the concrete. That marvelous statement in the Mundaka Upanishad. The earth is the footing of the Lord. The Psalms, and somewhere else also it occurs, the heaven is his throne, and the earth is his footstool. Isaiah too, I think it occurs. What sort of a house shall ye build me? I believe it comes. Never mind, but it comes in the Bible, you see. So you see, the heavens and the earth are not unrelated things. They are actually one and the same total reality. So now, this abstract thought process which we talk of, that also is within the realm of speech. Those of you who really are deeply interested in this, study that hymn in the Rig Veda, the 10th book, number 125, I think, or 120, one of the two. But you will find it somewhere there if you turn the pages, of the Rig Veda, the 10th book of the Rig Veda. The hymn to Vach, the goddess of speech. It's an absolutely extraordinary hymn altogether. As a matter of fact, we read through it 2 or 3 years back here in these meetings. I think all of you have forgotten about it. However, there you'll see the significance and the dignity of speech and what speech implies. And note again how through the scriptures of the world we always have this aspect. That is to say, the scriptures which do not talk in terms of God. And God said. What else could they write? But, and God said. And the Lord God answered. It's impossible to avoid it. We do not understand what a marvelous faculty we have within us, this faculty of speech. And unhappily, we have even less understanding of how we degrade this faculty of speech, misuse it all along the line. How important speech is indicated in the recital of the Silas, in the Brahmajala Sutta. Out of the 26 lines of print, I think, which occupies the exposition of the five Silas, 15 of the lines are given to speech. And then later on in the Brahmajala, again the matter comes up, and a whole list of subjects which we had better not talk about if we want to live the holy life. Very significant. You really must study that Brahmajala Sutta in detail. It's a marvelous sutta. Alright. So, words then and speech, for all that marvel and magnificence, insofar as the totality of the manifested universe is concerned, have to stop. They fade away. Because with words, with speech, we are still confined within the bounds of Vijnana, just discriminative consciousness. When that talk stops, don't think for a moment that the sense functions have refused, have gone dead. They haven't gone dead. They haven't gone numb at all. They are still operative, but operative in, well, for as far as I am able to say, in a way I cannot describe. They are operative there. There's a sutta in the third volume of the Majjhima, I think it's the third volume, where the Buddha is talking about Sariputta entering the different states of consciousness. And he has something to say about it, which is very instructive. Sorry, I can't remember the exact number at the moment, the exact sutta, but you fish it out. Now, all this then comes, all the sense functions are pacified, rendered peaceful, rendered harmonious. The universe, being a live universe, will of necessity pour out its impressions upon the one in samadhi too, in the profoundest samadhi. It will necessarily do so. But those impressions will cause no disturbance in the mind of the meditator. And certainly there will be no disturbance in terms of a chattering back, in terms of our conditioned minds, our minds full of defilement at those impressions. There's the state of complete purity and with it equanimity. This upekkha, whose first meaning is indifference, the ordinary dictionary meaning, indifference. It is not a state of indifference at all. It is a state of supreme, intense sensitivity. But a sensitivity of such a transcendent nature that there is no disturbance of any sort whatsoever. So the cessation of the thought process means the end of awareness in terms of finitude and mortality. This is one of the meanings of resurrection, ascension, the conquest, as they call it, of death. It is not a conquest of anything at all. It is not a bypassing of death or an overleaping of it. But it is a waking up
to a wholly new dimension of being and consciousness through the portal which we name death. And it is done and it is realized here and now. But what wakes up is not you. Because you or I stand only for the limited and everlastingly the limited, the mortal. This totality comes to self-consciousness in the living organism. It wasn't possible to escape from using the language that was used to try and suggest these states. When we come to the different samapattis, as they are called, he enters upon and abides in the plane of infinite akasha. What is akasha? What do we mean by that word, or try to mean by that word? You know, way back in the Upanishads, and I think also in Mahayana Buddhism, you will find this expanded. Akasha and prana go together. In the sense they correspond in the teachings of the Kabbalah to Chokhmah, wisdom, and Bina, intelligence. To father and mother. Wisdom is the father. Intelligence is the mother. Prana is the father. Akasha is the mother. But prana fecundates Akasha by virtue of pure presence. That's all. In the Sankhya philosophy, it is presented as Purusha and Prakruti. The male, the transcendent male aspect of this primordial creative energy, fecundates by virtue of mere presence. It's an influence. This is the way we can talk. This is all talk now, remember, after all. You see? Fecundation. But you can sense it in the deep states if you succeed in getting there. And out of this feminine, the mother, is the mother which contains the ambivalence, the duality. And it is within the mother alone that the duals interact and produce the entire manifested universe. You see, in entering the samapattis, what has happened is that energies which are transcendent in nature, they never intrude upon what we call the material world. They are present, they simply are present, but now they have the opportunity to manifest. This is what happens. So entering upon and abiding on the plane of infinite akasha, because we use words, necessarily we have to talk in terms of a succession. We cannot talk in terms of simultaneity. It's impossible to talk of everything in simultaneity. And the next which is mentioned is infinite vijnana. Infinite vijnana, remember, not our ordinary vijnana. The non-limited, the unlimited. Therefore the non-dimensional. You see, therefore the non-constricted. These two are simultaneous.
Everything in this transcendent realm is simultaneous. There is nothing which is separated out, in fact. Now, when this condition prevails through the limited, finite person who, because of his purification, has become the chalice of the spirit, so to say. This is one of the significances of the Holy Grail, the meaning of the Grail, and so forth. You have become that Holy Grail. When this happens, then you are a center for transcendent energy to influence the total psychical atmosphere to such an extent that immense purification takes place, unbeknown to those around. You are an instrument of divinity, if we may use those terms. You are the vehicle of the Most High. You know, in Christianity it is presented as the descent of the Holy Spirit into the chosen one, into the sin. And remember, the chosen one is the sinless one. The sinless one, which means not merely the one free from all the defilements. That, of course, is taken for granted, but that's the kindergarten stage. But this sinlessness is the complete freedom from any sort of isolative, separative self-consciousness or object consciousness. This is the sinless condition. Now, this sort of what happens has been expressed. At least human beings have tried to express this. And of course, it is extremely difficult to express anything like this. But the terms, the archangels and angels. In Mahayana, we have all the grades of devas corresponding to the jhanas and the samapattis. We have all that. What does it mean? Who are these devas? Are they nice flappers with golden wings flying through space and giving the benighted people the impression that they saw flying saucers or whatever it was? You see, no, just that. This is the only way people could talk, especially in those days, about these things. They could only represent it symbolically. You might say, why are you talking about the untalkable? It's the nature of this beast to do so. Take that as the simplest answer, and you can dismiss the beast if you like. But you see, when we are gathered together in harmony with the open mind, with a clear critical intelligence also, then a stimulation can take place which could prove beneficial, which could perhaps open some door of light. We are always concerned with this problem. We may say what we like, but we never get away from it. What is the purpose of our existence? What is our destiny? These are ways, perhaps, of sensing what our destiny is. These ways may appeal to you, may bring forth an answering chord, or they may not. But one casts one's bread upon the waters and trusts it will become cake. That's all.
You see?
So now, this is involved in all the samapattis as such. The deep states of meditation, the deep states which culminate in the supreme samadhi, the supreme communion, where selfness is not, which is the end of all ill, which is the uttermost security from all the bonds, nirvana, to use the Buddha's own words in the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, the uttermost security from all the bonds, the state which is the unborn, the birthless, the unaging, undecaying, undying, and so forth, the stainless, the sorrowless. You enter the sorrowless realm when speech becomes quiet, when speech becomes pacified. Because speech holds the whole realm of dukkha within its purview. Consider deeply. Is not the bulk of the world's misery and sorrow caused through the instrumentality of speech? The wrong word, the hurtful word, and the word which is not spoken for the one that is longing for that word. That little word of affection, of appreciation, of recognition, of expressing the fact that there is a relationship between you and I here, seated together. So the unspoken word is also often one of the sources of ill, of man's sorrow and suffering. And the spoken word, of course we know, we've only got to read through the annals of history of any nation, and particularly all their diplomatic and political records, and see just exactly how speech has brought about misery and untruth everywhere, all over the world. Where are we? Meditation and what it implies and what it means. Therefore, when some such realization as this has come into being, in the deep states, the specific states, it completely transforms your whole psychophysical being. I wouldn't be surprised if someday science itself might be in a position to investigate the body of the perfected Holy One and discover that its brains, that his brain structure and the brain cells, and perhaps the cells of the rest of the body too, show a difference from the brain cells, certainly, of the worldly, the man of the world, the man in the state of dukkha. Some extraordinary purification, some extraordinary change is likely to take place in the body itself. So, your whole psychophysical being is transformed. And that transformation finds fruition in the mindfulness which is your daily mindfulness. Don't think for a moment that the daily mindfulness, you can now pack up and say, oh, I've done all my homework, I need not bother anymore. The Buddha says, right to the end of his days, mindfulness he practices. So then I better not say that I can dispense with mindfulness at any time. Now see, this mindfulness is the central thing. It holds the key to human fulfillment, to human flowering. That is why it is so supremely important. Samasati. And with it goes samasamadhi. And realize that it means perfect. Perfect mindfulness. Not merely right mindfulness, but perfect. Perfect in its intensity, perfect in its intellectual aspect, in its aesthetic aspect. There's a wonderful aesthetic aspect to this samasa. The beauty of the whole world, despite what we see and call its ugliness and pain, comes through to us. We touched upon this, I think, day before yesterday. That when one practices and lives by such mindfulness, anything and everything becomes utterly beautiful. If such a person says, "You are the beautiful one," to anybody and everybody, he is saying the absolute truth about that person. In my own little way, I know the truth of this, because I've experienced it with respect to a drunkard lurching on the street and vomiting, having just come out of the pub. I'm just giving one instance only. Now you see the implications of that. If one can see that beauty of transcendence in an extraordinary way, in what is commonly regarded and not unjustifiably regarded as evil, if one can see that beauty, it means also that there is a wonderful capacity for compassion, for right wisdom, for not grasping, for seeing that this is all part of a becoming process, ever changing, ever transforming. You see, then life gets transfigured, doesn't it? Becomes totally different. And the difference takes place and can take place only in the mind of man, nowhere else. This is where the human kingdom is unique, as every kingdom of nature is unique. The human kingdom is unique in just this way. Having plucked the fruit from the tree of life, the forbidden fruit, I scarred the tree of life and made it the tree of good and evil. Therefore, we all do it. I mean, this Adam and Eve story is a perpetual story, just occurring through all time with humanity. And thereby, I introduced my own dismissal out of Eden. And thank God, I dismissed myself out of Eden. Because had I stuck in that Eden, this possibility of the deeper dimensions of being and consciousness could never have come into being. I would have been in a cabbage paradise, a cabbage happiness forever and ever. But man is a curious species. He is the main trunk. He is the central trunk of the tree of life. All the other species are lateral branches whose growth is determined and restricted. But there is no end to man's growth, ever upwards, ever upwards. You remember we talked about this day before yesterday, I think, man and trees, a man and a tree. Ever upwards towards what? No fixed end. The infinite, the zenith, which has no measure. no dimension. And it is only man who can do this. That means you. It doesn't mean the other fellow. Oh, the arhat, the bhikkhu, the priest, the saint. You yourself, John Brown and Mary Smith. So don't you shirk your responsibilities. Otherwise your karma will fall heavily upon you. Not will fall, is actually operative. You see, no man can escape karma. Because I myself, the man, am my karma. Every single stimulus, every single impress, every action, every thought, every deed, immediately registers in the psyche. And the psyche is a living thing, and it is actually operating right now, from this very moment. That is why I cannot escape karma. And it is continuously operative. You will never get away from it. Don't think in terms, therefore, will justice be done or not done. It is taking place in a transcendent way, all the time, perpetually. You needn't bother whether it will come in this life or that life. You can go on chattering that way, somewhat regressively, like our anthropoid ancestor, till the cows come home. And the cows will be comfortable at home, then we shall still be chattering and miserable and quarreling about it. So don't worry. But when this transformation takes place in your whole being, you have done what there was to be done. Trod the path of holiness. And have brought into this world, here and now, holiness as a benediction upon yourself and the world around you. See where the Buddha talked with the Dhamma, lovely in the beginning, lovely in the middle, lovely in the end. No end to its loveliness, no beginning to its loveliness. It's all loveliness. Meeting, because I go back on Friday morning.
I beg your pardon? May I ask a question?
Yes, please.
The infinite is this the principle of reincarnation?
Nothing to do with it. In the realm of transcendence, there is no such thing as succession operative. See, these are, you know, this is where the difficulty comes. And one attempts to talk about the transcendent. All are categories. Space, time, matter, causation, succession, birth, growth, death, the whole lot utterly disappear. That is why you have to be very careful. That's one of the reasons why I prefaced what we considered today with the words, if you bring the feeling element into it, you see, and thou sort of just sense it as such. You could be free from the intellectual categories. All these categories are intellectual, you see, space, time, matter, etc. They're intellectual categories. They won't interfere with understanding. Because the depth of understanding is quite beyond logical, intellectual ascent or descent.
Has it not been said or given somewhere that karma never makes a mistake?
It can't.
Karma never errs.
How can karma make a mistake? I mean, it's, look, karma means that all the forces which are present are just operating. They will necessarily produce their result. That is all. See? This is where things like the study of modern applied mathematics and science and all that is very helpful. It enables the mind to grasp rather more clearly, luminously, what these things mean, more clearly than in the olden days, when they didn't have these aids. This is also where, if you have that kind of mind and interest, the interest is most important. If you have that kind of interest, the study of the history of religious thought is very revealing. To give you one practical illustration of that, consider the religious production before about the 7th century BC and after. Before the 7th century BC, as far as I'm aware, if I'm wrong, please correct me, there was no atomic theory as such, no conception or intellectual speculation about the nature of the world in terms of the infinitely small, something indivisible, invisible, indestructible, which combining, recombining, produced all the different things in the world. You see? That comes into being after the 7th century BC. Kapila in India, and I forget who were the Chinese who developed it. And then Democritus, Leucippus, who was the other chappy?
Sumerians.
Who?
Sumerians did. And in Sumeria.
And in Sumeria? Hmm. I didn't know that.
Pythagoras.
No, but that Pythagoras comes. Oh yes, he comes before Democritus. You see, yes. Now they developed these things, ideas. Now when these ideas became current, look at the formulation of religious philosophies. They underwent the corresponding change. The idea of God as invisible, indivisible, indestructible, and so forth is associated, in fact, emerged out of the acceptance of Democritean ideas in Greece. And the same sort of thing you find in the Indian philosophies, the religious philosophies. So you see, the mind is helped to become clearer and clearer. This is where the growth of science philosophy is a help, provided we don't lose sight of the fact, first and foremost, that I don't know. If the mind is clean of all self-conceit and it's kept open, then you grow. That's very important.
So that both the help and the hindrance at the same time are there, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Well, that's in the realm, in the sphere of duality, you have to you have to accept that.
Is there any point to be afraid of in the foster that you're living in?
I'm sorry, I don't...
Is there anything to be afraid of in the foster that you're living in?
Is there anything
to be afraid, afraid of?
To be afraid of. Transcendent power or energy in itself has no fear involved in it. As I say, it has none of our categories, none of our qualities involved in it. It is utterly free. What we have to fear is not their operation on us, but the consequence of our tampering with our own mental states in such a manner that we produce unpleasant results for ourselves. You know, there are those who are so blind to the fact that absolute purity of the individual is the indispensable basis that they go into, well, so many so-called occultists, you see, who tamper with various ceremonial, ritualistic observances and so forth, and all the rest of it. What happens is just this, that they play about with their own minds as they are, energize both aspects, the good and the bad, and then get swollen toes.
Swollen heads,
you see, and suffer the consequences. Then they blame it onto some principle of evil. Never take leave of good sense. Never. See, there's nothing to be afraid of. You deal with the cleansing of the temple. All that man has to do is to cleanse this temple. And then, we talked about this the other day, the dweller in the temple is discovered to be no other than Shiva himself. In the Bible too, know ye not ye are the temple of the Most High? And it's very interesting that the Greek word used there is naos, isn't it? Gilbert?
Yes.
Isn't the Greek word used there naos?
Naos.
Yes. Yes. Ye are the temple of the Most High. And that wonderful statement, heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. What sort of a house shall ye build me? The Lord God asks. What does the yogi answer? This is the temple. Heaven, earth, the footstool, you see. And when the whole thing is perfect, Shakti, energy wrapped up here, rises to union, Shakti rises to union with her Lord Shiva, then comes right down again. Transcendentalizing all your own psychophysical functions. Transcendentalizing them. And then they rise up again and reside here at Anahata. This is symbolic language, remember, which means Anahata represents the plane of humanity. All humanity is embraced here. And when the time comes for the dissolution of this, up they rise again there and return to the infinitude of non-being. See? This is the meaning of it. And this in the Upanishads is spoken of in this way, that whatsoever a man thinketh upon, that he becomes. Therefore, think upon Brahman. You can't think upon Brahman. Thinking is a chattering process. This thinking means that mode of awareness which is transcendent.
you see, which has gone beyond the bounds of vijnana. Vijnanam anidasvanam anantam sabbatopapam, it has become. You see? So, in that state of communion with Brahman, if that state of communion with Brahman prevails at the time of death, he returns no more. And of course, that is how it is written. And everybody thinks that it refers only to physical death. It doesn't. It refers, when you enter these deep states, you have died to the dualistic world. You have died to the ambivalent state, and you have resurrected and ascended into the transcendent, unitarily whole state. All these things are absolutely wonderful. But when that becomes your normal state, as Pythagoras said, and when he reaches the highest ether, he becomes a god, immortal, never to die. This, of course, will die, but you must understand the symbolism of it. This is man's destiny.
Is that the cabbage-like existence you're talking about?
Is that the cabbage-like existence you are talking about?
Is what the cabbage-like existence?
The last one.
Now, the cabbage-like existence should have been had enough to come out of the garden.
Yes. You see, look. No, you don't return to a cabbage like it. Look, the significance, one of the very interesting significances of the angels and the demons, the suras and the asuras, is just this. The dualistic activity of the energies of the universe are anabolic, they build up, or they are catabolic, they disrupt. You see? And they do it in terms. Anabolically, something is built up, and when that particular manifestation has fulfilled its purpose, then the catabolic process sets in and it is disrupted. You see? So, this is what they represent. That means that the angel, poor devil, can't help being an angel, and the devil, angelically enough, cannot help being a devil. They are fixed. Now, man is not fixed. Man has this power of looking within and growing to aware of selfness. He becomes aware first in separatist terms. Then he becomes aware in the non-separatist term, which is the fulfillment. But to become aware in the separatist term, he has to pluck the fruit of the tree of life. What is the fruit of the tree of life? Consciousness. Consciousness. And when he plucks it, you see, without all that wealth of experience which makes him master of the dualistic sphere, he's plunged in the conflict of the duals. And that is the tree of good and evil business. The conflict of good and evil. Then, having gone out of them by the sweat of thy brow, thou shalt earn thy bread. Do you think that the Lord God, that Yahweh Elohim, those words are marvelous words and what they stand for. Do you think that he was concerned with some stuff made out of wheat? Earn thy bread, thy spiritual bread, thy spiritual sustenance. By the sweat of thy brow thou shalt earn thy spiritual sustenance. It won't be just given unto you freely in the paradisical state. So finally you regain your paradisical state. But with full consciousness, no longer this separative consciousness, no longer dualistic, no longer sinful.
So it's like the tree growing all the time.
So that the tree is this. Yeah. Right here, this is your tree, and this is your garden.
Just as a child, we have to grow.
Yes, quite. Mm.
I have tried to put all this in a chapter in my new book, which I hope will be sufficiently lucid to help one or two people. It's very difficult, I mean, to compress all this in a single chapter. Too much involved.